Welcome to the Global Council podcast, where you can hear the GC team discuss and debate topical developments in public policy and regulation from around the world.
Hello, I'm Tom White, one of the directors at Global Council. Welcome to our podcast today, looking at one of the major events of the last month in Brussels, which has been the launch of the Conference on the Future of Europe. It's the first major assessment of the EU's powers and institutional relationships in two decades. And I'm delighted to be joined today by my colleague, Maarten Lemstra, one of our researchers who joined from the Klingendaal Institute in the Netherlands, as well as Sophia Rusak from CEPS, the Centre for European Policy Studies, who is, in my view, the preeminent authority on the Conference on the Future of Europe, having been one of the first commentators and analysts in Brussels to really take it seriously as a phenomenon, and who has been leading a number of discussions about what its purpose, what its challenges, and what its ultimate outcomes might be. I'd like us to kick off with a bit of an introduction from each of us about why we think it matters. From my perspective, I think it's very important in that we don't do this very often in Brussels. We don't always often find enough momentum and enough reasons to reassess the institutional power balance. And clearly, there have been challenges over the last 10 years in the EU's ability to address questions around financial stability, around public debt, or even more recently, around coordinating responses to the pandemic, because some of those institutional structures were sometimes hampering political decision-making. So it's always interesting when we are able to get these kinds of debates opening. And I think that it's also being approached in a much more open way than perhaps previous treaty change negotiations, in that it's actually not being presented as a negotiation. It is very much a dialogue, albeit one with a probably an end game that will look a lot more like a political negotiation. But Sophia, why don't you tell us why you think this matters?
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for this very kind introduction, and thanks for inviting me to speak about this topic. Indeed, I'm quite passionate about it and try to follow it very closely. You know, I find it I find this is so let's say the conference should improve the way that the EU works, but so far it basically only has exemplified, you know, what's going wrong. And I think this is from, you know, from a research perspective why it is very interesting to see what's happening at the moment. It has so far demonstrated, you know, turf battles between the institutions. It is what we've all seen, you know, in the first year when it was all about who's going to lead the conference, and you know, it also continued last week, as we've seen that, you know, even the start of the conference has always been postponed over disagreement of the question, like who's actually taking decisions in the end. Anyhow, so you see a lot of fundamental disagreement, and I think this really boils down and kind of showcases and kind of lays bare, let's say, the question and the deep disagreement of what should the EU be, you know, and how, who should lead it. And that is something that has been an issue throughout the history of European integration, and that has mainly been a conflict between the supranational institutions, so the Commission and the Parliament and the Member States. But also really within the member states, because there's also many divided lines there. And traditionally disagreement on how the EU should look like. So this is really the crucial, the pivotal question here. And if we look at, you know, the two camps, and then we see that the parliament is super ambitious and it wants really deep change on the way the EU functions through this conference. And member states on the other side, they want to keep the power to themselves, how the EU looks like. And the thing is that member states are the ones that are in the driver's seat. And that means any idea, you know, about the future of the EU is only as good as member states are also willing to implement it.
I think that's interesting what you said about member states, and there's one member state in particular that has driven the attention on the conference being France. And of course, we had Macron's speech on the weekend launching the conference. Martin, perhaps I could come to you if you introduce a bit why you're focused on this conference, and maybe you can make sure we sort of bring us all up to speed on where we stand now in the process and what's actually happening.
Sure, Tom. So this idea has been floating around for a long time now. Initially, it was planned to start in 2020, but because of the pandemic, it has been postponed. It's an opportunity to get citizen input, but on another level, it's also an opportunity and contains a significant element of interinstitutional negotiations. Procedures are very important in Brussels, and that reflects in how long the different institutions took about agreeing about the exact procedures and the joint declaration, which was published a while ago. So how is this conference organized? Well, it's chaired by von der Leyen, by President Sassoli of the European Parliament, and by Costa from the Portuguese presidency. But the executive board, where the practical decisions will lie, is chaired again by Parliament, the Council, and the Commission. This is important because this executive board will, in the end, draw upon the plenary and publish the conclusions of the conference. So it will consist of both an online platform where citizens will be able to discuss, organize events, and exchange ideas. It will also consist out of randomly drawn citizens in so-called citizen panels, which must include at least one-fourth of people below 25. So the inclusion of young people is also very important. And lastly, there is also a conference plenary where 433 participants, again with representatives from European Parliament, from national parliaments, from the Council, from the Commission, and several stakeholders from civil society, such as, for example, the Committee of Regions, the Economic and Social Committee, we'll discuss vital topics. Topics to be discussed are, for example, health, EU in the world, digital transformation, European democracy, migration, and many others. There is also one specific topic called other ideas, and this has been flowing up on the online platform quite substantially again, because there are so many ideas which do not neatly fit into these topics as discussed. And as briefly mentioned already, there was an opening on May 9th, with lots of speeches, Macron expectedly going over time in a meandering speech about the European model, and interestingly as well about why Strasbourg is such an important and vital part of the European institutions. And it was interesting because immediately afterwards there was already an idea on the online platform saying Strasbourg should not be no longer be the seat of the European Parliament. They should move back to Brussels. So already here you can see whenever a president now says something in a speech, he can be sure that there will be an idea on this online platform stating the exact opposite.
Of course. Well, I wonder whether that IP address might end up being in The Hague. Maybe, Sophia, I could pick up on what you said about the different camps, that there are those who are looking at this as an opportunity for more federalism, more integration, and those that perhaps see it as more of a threat. I wonder, could you maybe break down for us a bit what is really at stake? So Martin mentioned one of the points about the double seat of the European Parliament, but what would you see as being the underlying core questions for the conference?
Yeah. So, you know, the conference is about two things. It's about policies and democracy. I mean, this is what they say. So policies, you know, as Martin already introduced, you know, there's these non-policy fields plus an open box where everybody can make suggestions. And then there is democracy as in representative and participatory democracy. So this means the parliament is really strong on, they're making a case to improve representative democracy in a sense that some open questions are clarified as to who and how the next commission president will be elected, buzzword lead candidate procedure, transnational list. I mean, these are two things that are floating in the debate already for a long time. So we've all heard it many times. As I said, the parliament is super ambitious, and so they want treaty change, they want all this institutional change, they want these participatory paths also improved by citizens' engagements, although every institution says they want the citizens engaged. But you know, I see a difference here because it's about the parliament that won. So the parliament is really the parliament's baby, let's say, is really these citizens panels, you know, with a number of randomly selected citizens. This is what they really pushed for. So for them, it is important that that also citizens are involved, that, you know, go beyond the usual suspects, which, you know, should be ensured with this randomized selection. So they want, you know, the preparation for the election. They want citizens engaged. The commission, they also speak about citizens' participation, and they also implemented it by coming up with this platform, which really is kind of the focal point of this institution. And yes, that is a means of citizens to engage directly, and, you know, much easier than we knew it from, other instruments that they are, you know, the European Citizens Initiative, for instance, and Citizens Dialogues. And, you know, there are several instruments that the Commission has come up in the past years. And I would say, you know, this platform is by far the easiest for citizens to submit ideas and to get engaged. But, you know, the thing is that, and I find it a bit typical for the Commission again, because they are praising this and they're treating this as, you know, the panacea to solve all the problems. It's obviously not, because the problem is that it's very easy to ignore what's ever been submitted to this platform. You know, like for my, you know, I still, you know, wonder how exactly the ideas that citizens submit, you know, and these reports of these events, how they will kind of, you know, and what do they feed in, and how are they processed, and how much are they taking really serious? And I think it's a typical way for the commission to initiate a direct participation, you know, like, please tell us what you think, but don't force us to really take into account what you think, you see. We have the council, and yeah, again, this is not a surprise that member states, you know, they traditionally want to keep the power to themselves, and they traditionally, at least, you know, since the treaty of Lisbon and all the disaster with its ratification and, you know, the convention back then, this was really a taboo for a very long time to open the treaties. We have a few member states. Austria, for instance, it's an outlier. They are rallying for it already for a few years. And then, you know, Italy, Austria, France, obviously with Macron, is open for the conference and for deeper change. But, you know, really, I see basically almost all other member states on the other side, you know, especially in Eastern and Northern Europe, finding that it is not to citizens to decide about treaty change. It's Germany that kind of being a little bit in the middle, which is interesting, because in their presidency, they were, let's say, not very supportive, but they're still not enthusiastic, but they're getting there. So to wrap it up, I would say member states are most of them, you know, ranging from skeptical to kind of outright opposed. And this is kind of the little bit the institutional situation that we're here. And let me just say, I'm not surprised by either one of the institutions' positions, because it is very much in line with how they usually also act.
That's true. I mean, sorry, Martin, you were going to come in.
I would say here that what Sophia flagged about whether there will be follow-up is the key question surrounding the Conference of the Future of Europe. Because we've seen in the past initiatives where the EU institutions had grand claims but failed to follow up. It ended up in a drawer somewhere at the council, and that itself can put off citizens to engage with exactly these kinds of exercises. So you risk by now engaging with the citizens but not following up, you risk achieving the exact opposite, that citizens do no longer want to engage with this. But interestingly, it seems that the Commission and other ministers have also noticed that this is a key threat themselves. So at every occasion, the von der Leyen has been keen to stress that they want to follow up, this time on the conference, and Vice President Suica has said multiple times that there will be a feedback mechanism, which will talk about how ideas submitted will all actually be taken up. But as Sophia also mentioned, this does not do away with the veto powers and blocks which member states can impose to prevent actual change from happening.
Yeah, if I can just say one more sentence on the feedback, because this is also something that sounds, again, very nice, but what does it mean concretely? You know, does it mean that citizens get an email when they submitted an idea and they get another email if somebody else commented on their idea? This is not a feedback mechanism to me, see? So also there, we need to work a bit further. And one more example, you know, that you say that, Martin, and it's a very good point. 2018 European Citizens Consultation, you know, I'm not getting tired to mention this and to bring this back into people's memories, because this, we had a great attempt there of the commission, you know, with putting up a questionnaire, methodologically sound, with drawn up by a citizens panel of representative, you know, selected citizens and so on, like making a big effort, reaching out, 80,000 Europeans responded, 80,000, you know? So this is exactly what, like, how do you involve people? Like, who do you make sure that people care? You know, this is also behind it. You know, you have to deliver, that's it, you what you said, otherwise people get frustrated, but you also need to trigger interest. And this is beyond the usual suspects.
Absolutely. I mean, and if you think about, the expectations that can be raised by having a citizens' dialogue for this, where people are able to make their policy proposals around some very interesting topics that Martin ran us through. I think there will be some consequences for the EU if they just have a conference and they have thousands and thousands of ideas coming through, but then there's no follow-up. So I think maybe we want to come and have a look at what the next steps could be. You know, if this conference does get momentum and traction, as clearly President Macron is trying to give it. I mean, if I think about the convention on the future of Europe that I was involved with as a government official a long time ago, that felt like more of a top-down exercise. You know, it had clearly been driven by the fact that the EU was about to enlarge itself from 15 member states to 25, with more in the pipeline. You know, there was a real sort of sense of, I suppose, top-down political pressures for sorting out, you know, the voting rights, the institutional roles, and the composition of the parliament. So there was a deadline and an external reason. Whereas when we look at this conference, I mean, there's no shortage of external reasons that mean you need to think about these questions. You know, we've just seen the EU agree an enormous increase in its financial firepower and the sharing of liabilities for public spending. You know, we've seen transformation in the relationship with the United States over the last few years, with many in Europe now doubting how much they can rely on the US as a partner for security and for maintaining multilateral bodies. And of course, within the EU, we've seen enormous change with the departure of one of the largest member states in the UK. So, you know, there are all sorts of reasons to take a step back and have a debate. But I think they are perhaps lacking the sense of a real deadline or reason for why decisions need to be taken and not just sort of kicked further down the road. The reason I mention all of this is that there is one important deadline that will be not lost on any of our listeners in France, which is that we have a presidential election next year in France, with President Macron having made a lot of his pitch to voters about France's role in Europe. I'm just interested in your views on where, how might that impact on what the conference does and where its conclusions go?
Yeah, well, it had already its impact in the way that it's set up, and I mean in the time frame, you know, that it was supposed to last 2 years to give, you know, ample time to all the discussions that that are needed. And you know what happened due to Corona and interinstitutional turf battles, we've been cut down. The conference has been cut down by 1 year, or cut into half. You know, let's say it like that. And why is it not just, you know, still running 2 years? This is, of course, because of, you know, it's Macron's baby and it's French election time next year and it's French it's going to be the French presidency. So Macron is very eager to keep it that way. And of course, he doesn't have a lot of opposing voices in the European Council because the others don't really care about it, you know, to start with. So this is the impact that it had so far. I mean, it's a good thing that, you know, that at least one of the European leaders is kind of, you know, very fond of this exercise. But I really wonder how meaningful this is with, you know, half of the time that was initially planned. You know, if we only look at the work that the citizens panels do, you know, I mean, you do all this effort and you bring together 800 people, so four panels times 200 people, as Matt said, and then you let them discuss basically everything that the EU does. You know, I mean, 9+ topics on the webpage. You know, let's say, you know, another 3 is going to be added. You know, what does it mean that every one of the panels then discusses 3 topics? Is it going to be climate change, migration, and I don't know, EU foreign policy in 7 days? You see, like, this is, I mean, because this is what it is. It's going to be about 7 days that these citizens panels each have time to meet. So I'm a little bit, you know, it all looks very nice and I'm happy that institutions agreed on this setup, but when it comes to timing, then I think things, it's all quite quite short. And this is thanks to Macron.
And of course, if we could look at the member state you know best in Germany, also facing an election in the autumn and a new chancellor. How significant is all of that? You know, are we going to see either the European agenda play a role in the German election, or could we see the German election have an impact on this process?
Well, so to be honest, the European debate or the debate around the EU disappeared, like vanished a few days after the presidency was over. And this is simply because then, you know, the election campaign started and no, European politics does not play a big role so far in the election campaign. So it was really a clear shift towards national, as a very national focus again. You know, it's funny because the Germans, as I said, they were not really ambitious. It was not a priority during their presidency. Although, you know, Chancellor Merkel was writing this non-paper with President Macron, which I'm kind of curious how he got her convinced to do that, because it doesn't really kind of, you know, seems to be in her core field of interest. Anyhow, she did. And then since then, you know, it had been picked up a little bit with the Portuguese president. But the question is, so due to the election campaign, I would say this topic is really overshadowed. So I don't expect, we should not expect any German initiative on the EU scene until the elections. What happens as of September, October, it will probably take a few months to build a new government. So actually we're talking about next year. So basically, you know, so until the end of the year, I think Germany is a little bit out of the European picture. Then what is the outlook? Well, I think there are quite high chances for a government that might be, you know, more enthusiastic about European politics, as in a Green, or at least, you know, Greens are quite likely to be at least in the government, and maybe even a Green Chancellor, which is not so unlikely anymore. But in any case, to be honest, I'm not super convinced that, you know, the course of European politics is changing dramatically.
One thing which is interesting to flag, perhaps, is that if you look at the European Parliament, which party there is most interested in pushing an integrationist agenda, it's the Liberals and the Greens. So if you, for example, see the Observer, Daniel Freund, an MEP in this executive board, the inter-party connection between him and a more prominent Green position in German government could, to an extent, be substantial. Also interesting because the Greens have in their manifesto to move to QMV on foreign policy issues, qualified majority voting. And this is also something which is floating around as a possible conclusion for the Conference of the Future of Europe, at least to see to what extent this can be expanded. So if we could see a more Green-dominated German government because of the federal elections in spring, this could also be one of the things which comes at least a bit closer to reality, I would say.
Yeah, totally. No, you're right. But of course, you know, there is always a big difference between the parties on national ground and the parties that, you know, are from put together, or the sister party, so to speak, here on European level. And the Daniel Freund and his Green colleagues, they are super ambitious, and they bring up, you know, like very clear and very demanding ideas, which I find, you know, very interesting. But again, that doesn't mean that the German Greens in Germany, you know, have the same line, although I think they have quite good ties. And then again, second thought is that as soon as a party is in the executive and in government, you know, then also quite a lot of things change. And the Greens, I mean, they have more and more government experience by now in Germany, for sure. I mean, no doubt, but still, you know, they have never been in the position that they're now, you know, aspiring to be. So let's see what happens once they reach there.
And if we think about that spectrum that you outlined earlier, Sophia, between member states that are maybe kind of lukewarm or disinterested, and then at the other end, very sceptical, which other member states should we be watching as to who's going to be mobilised? Of course, we and our listeners know that France and Germany are going to be important, but which other countries should be paid attention to?
Yeah, so exactly. So Austria, I said already, as an outlier, which we know, like one of the driving forces of institution change quite early on. And then also, yeah, France is now no surprise, as I said, Italy and Spain also. Then, you know, the reluctant camp is clearly in the east of Europe, eastern and central of Europe, I would say, where they, you know, either are, you know, opposed, or let's say at best not interested, and kind of have a sense of, okay, we're going to let our, you know, our people contribute to this in whatever form, but, you know, we as a government, we're not kind of, you know, really buying into this. Also, yeah, as I said earlier, there's no way that citizens are deciding on treaty change. And, you know, the northern states, they are, you know, quite similar stance, I would say, than the Eastern European countries, also when, like, quite harsh on no treaty change, no institutional change, and very, very policy fields or let's say policy orientated, you know, any change that should come out of this this conference should rather look at what the EU is doing and not how it is doing what it does. So you've seen the letter that 12 member states have published, you know, a few weeks back, and, you know, Poland and Hungary were not even included in that. And there, you know, they kind of outlined their common approach towards the conference. And here they again state very clearly, really, that the conference should focus on concrete policy, and that even more so, not only on concrete policy, but also on the council's strategic agenda. So, you know, basically already setting the frame in which citizens should discuss topics.
And this non-paper you mentioned, I think, is very relevant. It has been signed, amongst others, by Austria, the Netherlands, Denmark, but also Slovakia and Latvia. And one key line from this is that it should not create legal obligations or interfere with already established legislative processes. So here, again, you can see that these member states pushing back on the idea that this conference plenary conclusions are somehow directly applicable. And second of all, what you mentioned about Eastern Europe, I think, is very relevant, because if we're looking at the next part of the year, when the ECDA is going to have a conclusion about the rule of law mechanism, and probably the Commission is going to apply this rule of law mechanism, my guess is, my estimation is, that we're going to see already tense relations with Hungary and Poland get even tenser, even more so because Hungary is heading towards an election year in early 2022. So this undoubtedly will be a topic discussed during the Conference of the Future of Europe. But it can also mean that any conclusion in this field coming from these member states, you know, they could use their veto if they don't like the conclusions as they are presented to them. So this is something to keep in mind.
Exactly. For any treaty change, we need unanimity. That is really important to always keep in mind. And any change needs to be implemented also by these governments. So either they veto it altogether, or they don't implement in their member state. So it's crucial to get them on board.
So what I'm hearing is it sounds like there's a very narrow path to success, where the conference needs to be focusing on practical policies without duplicating or cutting across the normal legislative processes in Brussels. It needs to address some of the bigger inter-institutional questions without making treaty change the kind of central channel for delivering it, and keeping the member states on board with a process that they could veto further down the track. And at the same time, it needs to be a process that engages and enthuses enough citizens or their sort of civil society representatives to have a lot of policy ideas generated and fed in through these panels and platforms. So there's a real job ahead for making sure it's got momentum and impact. And of course, it can't really fail completely, because that would have huge consequences for Macron and for the French presidency. So we have a lot of quite big pressures to manage. How do we see that happening? You know, if there was going to be a successful conference, which I would define as being a conference that has aired the big issues and settled at least some of them, you know, what are the main sort of steps along the way that we should be looking out for, and that our listeners should be looking out for, ahead of that set of conclusions in the spring? You know, how will we know if we're on track, I suppose?
Well, I think a good, I don't think there's a clear benchmark. What I think is a good indicator is, I think, media coverage. I think this is something that we all should kind of, you know, in our national home countries have a look at and see how things develop, because this is super important, of course, to make it known outside the usual suspects, and to reach down citizens directly, you know, without, and maybe even in you know, also in those member states where the governments are currently not so much of a fan, because, you know, we noticed not always the government and the people think the same way about the EU. So this is important that the media kind of, you know, does its job. And this is also, you know, for us to see in how far this happens. And I mean, as I said, in Germany, this hasn't happened much yet. I think another thing that is also important is to include diverse opinion, to not only, you know, include the same voices and the same pro-European voices. You know, we were talking about the platform earlier and looking at, you know, who contributed so far. My feeling is also that it's quite pro-European, which, you know, is beautiful. But then again, you know, it's not really a representative of society. So it's important that also those will be included in all kinds of way that have critical voices and even, you know, maybe, you know, anti-EU sentiment. Because then again, you can draw more attention, I think, also, because the day of debates will be more interesting. And you can have more diverse debates. So I think these are things that are important. When it comes to things to look at, you know, what is happening in the near future, then we have the first plenary meeting. I don't know yet so much what to expect from it, to be honest. It's probably a little bit like the inaugural event, you know, where everybody was looking at, and in the end, you know, yeah, it's been a bunch of political speeches and classical music. But let's see. Maybe this is, you know, the next event where we also will get to know a little bit of, because until now it's all rules, you know, and how are they put into practice? You know, how do things really pan out in reality? And I think the first plenary meeting in June might be kind of a first, you know, a first touch and feel.
If I can point out one thing which I think will be crucial, and again, I agree very much with Sophia, it's representative and active participation. And I think one thing which will be crucial for this is if member states will actively promote it amongst their citizens and actually get this conversation going. Because, for example, what we saw with the European Convention about the previous constitution, in the Netherlands, no one really paid attention to it. And therefore, it did not really come as a big surprise to many that the Dutch voted against the conclusion. So what needs to happen is that also in member states, which are perhaps not as looking for grand sweeping change, that also these member states actively promote it, that it ensure that it's heard, because I think national parliamentarians have a very large role to play to activate people, to bring out the people to participate. And the fact that 108 representatives of national parliaments are present in the conference plenary will hopefully be a sign that this is something which could get underway as the conference progresses.
Yeah. And one more thing on the member states promotion, by the way, I'm wondering, like, why don't they take up this as a change more, as a chance to for treaty change? Because, you know, if we think back last time, it was a convention made up of mainly parliamentarians and government representatives who decided something that then was rejected by the public. Now, you know, they have the chance to work on something that, I mean, it's not a draft for a treaty, of course, you know, but they have the chance to work towards deeper change that will be discussed with citizens beforehand. So then also the risk to have the same, you know, dramatic situation as we had last time in the ratification process are lower.
I think in some ways this is going to be quite a big, exactly that question is going to be quite a political test for whichever individual or group decides to really run with the conclusions and try to make them happen, whether that is President von der Leyen or President Macron or a combination of them, to try and bring together the package so that it's sort of got enough for everyone to gain something. And that's where I think your point about diversity of views is important right the way through. I mean, one of the main ways in which the Lisbon Treaty was actually sold in the ratification process was the fact that there was, of course, a lot of integrationist measures in there, but there was also the creation of the principles of subsidiarity and the introduction of a procedure for member state parliaments to actually, you know, block or force a revision by the commission through the yellow card procedure. And so I think if there's a sense of yes, work out what else might need to be done at the European level, but also introduce some checks and balances so that we don't sort of further create a powerful remote elite, then you could see some of that coming together. I think the key challenge is just going to be, you know, which political leaders decide that it's worth doing that job and whether they can actually execute it. Obviously, we're at the start of this process, and I'm hoping, Sophia, we can regroup a bit further down the track to review how progress is going. But thank you so much for joining us. It's been really fascinating to get your insights and perspectives. Is there anything in the immediate term we should be looking out for in the processes? Is there a sort of a short term next steps that you would like to draw attention to?
Well, yeah, I think, as I said, in June, the plenary, and then, in autumn, but it's not, the date is not set yet, the first citizens panels. I think these are the next two interesting things that will happen.
And of course, the Slovenian presidency is soon to get underway as well. So it was Janša, for example, he already was a bit angry about the fact that he didn't also get an opportunity to give a speech during the opening. So, and Janša is, of course, someone who is an interesting figure. So it will be also interesting to see how his leadership will influence the conference as it goes on. Because, of course, the Slovene, they will have a significant position in the executive board through their presidency. So it will be important to follow what they have to say in the coming months as well.
True, yeah, good point.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Sophia. Thank you, Martin. And we'll reconvene probably in the autumn.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Martin.
For more insights, blogs and analysis, you can visit our website, global-council.com, and subscribe to our mailing list. And you can follow us on Twitter at global_council.